heart and soul of a nation, beckons the call. The voice of our forefathers heard in the distance.
A house divided against itself cannot stand.
To reclaim our honor.
Our soul. The challenges of a generation call out. Future generations hang in the balance. We choose liberty. This is the voice of a nation.
The nation.
And now, Malcolm.
So let's start by recapping a bit of where we're at, how we got here. And if you recall, this whole thing started with the fact that we were going to have a two-week cycle there, 2 weeks to sort of flatten that curve. Now, we all started here. In fact, we got educated on that whole flatten the curve thing, you remember, when Dr. Birx and Dr. Fauci and all of those came up and the task force came together. And at the time, at the moment, it seemed like a wild idea. We had never heard or seen anything like this in our lifetimes. But the fact that we're going to essentially lock down the country, like lock down all the states, and we're all going to hunker down. And it sounded like an extreme wild idea, this flattening the curve, the social distancing, and that we were going to have at least 2 million people dead, could be 10 times that amount. I mean, could be a serious problem here. Well, that was a rude awakening for everybody. And we all kind of felt, looking at what was happening in Europe, specifically in Italy, I mean, Northern Italy was targeted really hard, heavy. Spain, Germany, they all had problems, but Italy was especially targeted. And so then, and again, that's because in China, remember again, don't lose sight of this now, they again stopped their citizens from traveling within China. You see, they had their own lockdown there from Hubei province there, Hubei province, and then in Wuhan. So they stopped everybody from traveling within the country. But guess what they didn't do? They didn't stop them from traveling around the globe. So that's what happened. And then the world got infected and impacted from this pandemic, but not to the likes of what we were told, what we thought, what we understood could happen. Because let's face it, that was a scary moment. The fact that millions upon millions and millions of Americans could be dead from this pandemic. And I think with that much life at risk, Americans looked at themselves and decided and said, you know what, we're going to have to make this unprecedented move. That's what happened. And we agreed to it because at the end of the day, I think the American people, they get it. They're patriotic. They understand what it takes. And we're a resilient group of people. You have to admit that. And so we signed up for it. We went along with it for the two-week flatten the curve deal. But then that two-week flatten the curve thing ended up being extended another 30 days. And if you remember, the president was being called on the carpet by everybody on the left. You remember this moment there up at the task force and the daily conferences. He was being called on the carpet. You can't open this country back up. No way. That was really everybody ran those headlines. The president's being reckless. He cannot do this. And so then we extended another 30 days. Dr. Birx, Dr. Fauci got out there and started to say, hey, we got to go along with this thing because we got to flatten the curve more. And there's a risk still. And so then Americans dug down a little deeper. And then in the meantime, the government continued to play their games and they sent people $1,200 to shut the hell up and move along. See, now $1,200 isn't going to solve the world's problems, isn't it now, you know? But that was the game plan then. And of course, the Democrat game plan at that point, Pelosi came out and said, well, let's just keep everybody home indefinitely and we'll send them $2,000 a month. Well, that sounds like a brilliant idea, people, doesn't it? Just keep the whole damn country locked down indefinitely and continue to print money up there and we'll all get fat and happy in our homes and businesses being locked in, locked down. And it's crazy, isn't it? I mean, it's a fairy tale land, what we're talking about here. I don't know how you pinch yourself out of this thing. It's incredible. So now what's happening is we're seeing a lot of telltale signs from the residual of all of this. People are protesting. Americans are upset. They want they want their constitutional rights back. They want liberty back. Well, you see, Elon Musk came out and he said these calls for the stay-at-home orders are fascists, he says. He calls them fascists right out there. He said these orders go against our constitutional rights. And he put it right out there. He tweeted this. In fact, he tweeted, "Free America now," and people were paying attention. And he was criticized heavily for the tweets. He said, based on current trends, probably close to zero new cases in the U.S. too by the end of April, is what he said. And he came in under, and by the way, he was also on a Tesla earnings call the other day in a meeting with the executives there. He said the expansion of shelter in place, or as we call it, forcibly imprisoning people in their homes against all their constitutional rights, in my opinion, is breaking people's freedoms in ways that are horrible and wrong, and not why people came to America and built this country. And then he ended with a nice expletive in the meeting. It was something like WTF, you see? He said, if somebody wants to stay in their house, that's great. They should be allowed to stay in their house, and they should be not be compelled to leave. But to say that they cannot leave their house and they will be arrested if they do, well, that's fascism. That is not a Democrat. That is not freedom. It's not democratic. It's not anything. Give people back their, again, GD freedom, he says. You know, from a business leader, got a lot of attention, on social media, but it reminded everybody, both on the left and the right, is what I'm saying, is that even your top business leaders are getting unsettled. I mean, there's a lot of unrest out there. And by the way, as the communities are starting to open up slowly but surely, which I want to talk to you about more today, and we'll do that with Michael Johns in just a bit here as we dive more into this. But here's the thing. You're seeing the slow churning of this thing opening up, people. But still, it's like, okay, we can only let 50% of the people in the establishment. Some places it's 25%. Or you can only sit outside, but you got to be social distance away from each other if you're going to open up the restaurant. I mean, these are some strange rules here. You know, you're going to just run people down the sidewalk, I think, of the neighborhoods at the restaurants and hope it doesn't rain, I guess, or snow, whatever, huh? Wherever you live. It is kind of weird, but these are a lot of the rules being put into place. And a lot of this comes, I think, just from stupidity or from fear or ignorance or combination of all of those things, potentially, you know. In the meantime, domestic violence is rising. I mean, there are some real stats coming out of Johns Hopkins University. They state there's approximately 30 million additional cases of gender-based violence. And so that's rising. People are spending too much time with each other in these locked-in environments. I mean, what do you expect? You know, that's going to be a problem. You're going to see a lot of, and you know, there was another story I'll share with you here. They expect 7 million unplanned pregnancies from this, at least 7 million. I'd be surprised if it isn't more than that, quite frankly. Yeah. I mean, and this is, and there's a whole study on this. The UN did a study as well. And it's going to be a lot of new babies running around, let me tell you that. And I could go further with that, but probably more for the abortion clinics too to be dealing with, because they have no value of life, do they now? You know, the Planned Parenthood scam that is. How do we successfully open up our country again? We're already here. We've gone way beyond the 2-week period of time. So now the next question is, how do we do this? How do we afford this? And what is the risk factor from opening up the United States back up here? We'll talk more about that just ahead on The Voice of a Nation with Michael Johns.
Our global experts are brilliant writers and engaging hosts on a mission of a lifetime. You'll find the latest news and inspiration on the front page of AmericaOutLoud.com.
What if a new treatment backed by 17,000 scientific articles was proven to extend our lifespan, protect against terrible diseases like cancer, heart disease, and dementia, make us more attractive and thinner, feel calmer and happier, and boost energy levels, memory, and performance? What would you pay for even the smallest dose of this treatment? Well, the good news is you don't have to pay anything, because these are just some of the benefits of a full night of quality sleep. If you're one of the millions of Americans who need better quality sleep, the time to change is now. Until now, most sleep aids haven't worked, but a new, easy-to-swallow sleep gel, invented by the leading nutrition company, Healthy Cell, is designed to support all four stages of human sleep to help you fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deep, and wake up refreshed. It's called REM Sleep. To get a free two-night supply of REM Sleep, visit healthycell.com/sleep. That's healthy, CELL.com/sleep.
So joining me here on the program, friends, is Michael Johns. He is the national co-founder and leader of the Tea Party movement, a former White House speechwriter and a policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation. Michael, the first thing I've got that I want to talk to you on is I want people to understand what we're dealing with here financially. And I mean, I'm guessing we're going to spend, what, at least $10 trillion here with this whole thing by the time we're done? What is going to happen over the next few years with Trump based on all of this? And they're not going to cut spending. They're not going to cut the programs. They're not going to cut the social network, because in order to do that, they would demand to cut the military and demand to cut all the other things essentially that we need in America. You see the problem?
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is a crisis that, you'd mentioned we're unprepared for, and in some respects, it's almost very difficult to prepare for it. I mean, on a historical precedent basis, you'd have to go back to like the Spanish flu, early 20th century. I think I read a story earlier this week of a woman who's 101 who actually survived the Spanish flu at 1 or 2 years of age and went on to survive COVID-19. But let's be honest, I mean, the country was a very different place back then. Our healthcare resources were not as expansive. The country wasn't as big. The economy was very differently structured. So there's really no exact precedent that you can look to and say, hey, this is the blueprint on how you would prepare for this. And I think when you look at the state of things right now, we have, as of today, 1,067,382 cases, 61,849 deaths. So you start with the fact that you cannot deny that this is a legitimate and very real public health threat. And I'm hearing in some corners individuals questioning that. You hear people say things like, it's no more threatening than the common flu, or everyone incurs a little bit of risk and we need it. So this is a legitimate public health crisis. Yet when you break it down onto a state level, which is what you need to do, I think when you look at light at the end of the tunnel here, you realize we have 50 different sets of scenarios in 50 different states. So if you're talking about New York and New Jersey, combined, that's New York State, as of today, 306,158 cases, New Jersey, 116,264. That's over 40%. Of the total cases in the country. Now you can go to some other states, and it's kind of intriguing to look. Alaska, 355 total cases since the start, and only 106 current cases. Montana, 53 active cases in the whole state. Wyoming, 166 active cases in the whole state. Hawaii, 81 active cases in all of the Hawaiian Islands. Vermont, 807, only 817 active cases, only 886 cases since this started. You start to look at a lot of these states and say, well, there's massive room for not just an incremental reopening, but in some cases a full-blown reopening of this case, presuming these individuals that have been exposed are properly isolated while they recover. And, some reasonable preventative measures are taken, you can see a broad number of states in this country that are fully prepared to reopen. And in fact, some are in the process of doing that. And then you look at others, and I mentioned New York State, but, on the city level, 165,000 of these million plus cases are in New York City. That's over, 16%. And 12,774 deaths of the 61,006 over 61,000 that we've had. That's over 20% of the deaths have been in the five boroughs of New York City. So I think the conclusion you reach is that what is the state of the coronavirus in the United States? You can't state that there is an emphatic clear-cut national state of this crisis. It's varying. It's immensely threatening in two particular states. It's very threatening in probably half a dozen to 10 or so other states. And it's much less threatening in the remaining 25 plus.
So why are those states still in lockdown mode, the ones you just went through where it's hardly even been, you know, any kind of a problem? Why are they still in lockdown mode? Is it because of fear or is it because of control, do you think?
I think, you know, firstly, it's important to realize that, you know, when you look at what the federal government has actually done, they have put forward policy recommendations. They provided a lot of resources. They put in place the hugely important and constructive travel ban the end of January against China and subsequently against some other areas that have kind of stopped the bleeding, which is the first step you do in a public health crisis like this. But all of these restrictive measures that are concerning to the American people, that are bothersome to America, are being imposed by states and communities, state and community governments. In those cases, you know, what are the motivating factors? Overly, you know, precautious steps in some cases, political factors in others. Certainly the, you know, in some ways, maybe the easier of the two decisions is to remain closed, because you can, in the eyes, I think, of most policymakers, always bring back a job, but you can't bring back a life. But even that can be kind of a cliche misstatement. Can you, in fact, bring back all these jobs? You know, and we're predominantly, it's not mentioned enough, a country whose employment is very small business based.
Yeah.
So large companies get all the attention. We talk about large companies day to day. But when you really look at where do the American people work, they work at companies that have under 100 employees, and a large percentage that have under 50 employees.
Yeah.
And those companies that have been closed, you know, now going on months with no revenue flow and still operating overhead and costs are going to be very burdened in this reopening.
We're in a gig, you know, many of these people, as you say, it's a gig economy, and these are a lot of service-oriented type of people, Michael. So they rely on check to check, paycheck to paycheck. You know, that's just the way it is. And there's a whole lot, there's millions and millions of those people. And like you just said, they've been closed now for a couple of months now. And the employees are being hit really hard, as well as the businesses themselves. And really the engine of America is small business. It's not the big cats. It's really the small businesses, which is, of course, what the political leaders always get up there and talk about. Well, we want to help small business, but are they really doing that? And you see by the way, you see these signs lately, the relief bill that they put out to help the business community. All these big companies have been targeted. I mean, you see the Los Angeles Lakers did it. You've seen all these major companies. Disney did it. They all took money, and then they all had to apologize with egg on their face. In other words, you have to fill out an application. You have to go online and do all this. You have to request the money. And it really wasn't for them. Some of them were getting $5, $10, $15 million. And then the whole pot went belly up. There was no money left. That was wrong too, wasn't it?
Yeah. And again, I mean, I come back to the point that there's no precedent. So you're saying activate the, you know, the region and the Department of Treasury that handles our emergency relief funds for exclusively designated to small business with all of the varying qualifications that we've put out about how those funds are to be used. There is no such department.
Well, why didn't they put a cap on it? Why didn't they put a cap on it, you know?
Because you have companies of varying sizes. The idea here, remember, these are loans predominantly, not grants. And these loans are designed to keep American people attached to their places of employment until such time as we get out of this crisis. That is crucially important as a function. I mean, we don't want to have to be in a position of recreating this whole economy in the summer or early fall. It's got to be one of saying, okay, we've taken an enormous hit to GDP, to employment, to economic infrastructure, but basically people now have been able to get through this, continue their employment affiliation, and reestablish basically their lives. I mean, we lost over 26 million jobs really in a matter of a couple months here. You know, and I and others look at it independently and say, yeah, this is in fact true. He had every metric of this economy headed in the most positive direction really in the history of this country. employment metrics, growth metrics, wages increasing, minority employment hitting historical highs. These were some real extraordinary accomplishments. And a lot of us were looking forward to the point where we'd be able to say we had GDP over 3%, et cetera. Now, of course, the GDP came out this week and you have a negative GDP number for the first time in many years. But let me just tell you something. It wasn't as low as I thought it would be. I mean, I think there was a lot of broad Wall Street speculation. That number would be about negative 10%. Mm-hmm. Came in at negative, a little over negative 4. Yeah. Second quarter is going to be an absolute train wreck. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. But ultimately, the key here is I think the president's put in place the sort of measures, imperfect as they may be, because really you had to deal with Democrats, you had to put this thing together. There's no historical precedent really to draw on. You know, there's every good reason to believe that we're going to ultimately come through this.
Yeah. You know, when you say there's no historical precedent to draw on, and I understand that, to really go back, because you have to go back again to that Spanish flu back in 1918, 1919. And I understand that there was no blueprint for that. But here's the thing. When I say we weren't ready or responsible, what I'm talking about is financially responsible. The fact of the matter is, and you as representing the Tea Party know this, if Washington had not been spending money so recklessly over the past 15 years that they've done, we'd have been in a better position to handle a crisis like this. So two thoughts here. As the states now are asking for money from Washington, you see New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy up there meeting. He met today with the president, in fact, asking for federal funds. He qualified it and said in his memo on this, he's not asking for bailout funds. He didn't like the word bailout, by the way. He wanted money to exactly that was impacted from the pandemic, that he blamed it on, all of these costs and the lack of funds that they've been able to not have been able to create because of the pandemic. And other states are lining up behind them. You see the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, he's asking for God knows how many billions of dollars to get the feds to bail New York City out, he said. They're entitled to it. You start taking all these states and all these cities with their hand out looking at the feds. What do you think happens with that picture?
Well, one of the good things is I like the fact that Governor Murphy and Cuomo, as much as I've not been supportive of them, have been bold enough and mature enough to go down and actually meet with the White House and talk about how to get through this thing. You want to see that in our leaders, that they're able to suspend partisan loyalties. And these, let's be clear, these are two highly partisan Democrats, and both very much on the liberal side.
Well, they're doing it publicly, probably not privately, but publicly.
Well, yeah, and you could be cynical about it. You could be cynical about it and say, yeah, they want to go back and sort of say these were shared decisions. So if they don't go well, they can turn around and blame the Trump White House and not be held accountable for them. Say, hey, we ran them by the White House. I'll be a little bit cynical and say that is probably possible. But I do think both these states, are working pretty well with the administration. So this talking point that somehow this president is politically divisive or incapable of working across party lines has totally been proven wrong throughout this crisis. He's worked incredibly well in his administration and personnel worked incredibly well with Democrat governors across the country. And even in these various stimulus packages, some of which were immensely put together very quickly. And I think in the grand scheme of things were done decently. There's mistakes in them. There's errors in them. There's billions of dollars that probably should have been allocated differently than it was. But when you're talking about trillions of dollars in ultimate allocations, it could have been a lot worse. And I think he really, did a good job. And Mnuchin did a particularly good job in working with congressional Democrats to get these things done.
So do you see the federal government bailing some of these states and cities out? Is that whatever word we want to use? Do you see that happening? They got their hand out. They're asking for money. Are they going to get it?
Well, they have all kinds of mechanisms available to them. I think ultimately one of the biggest issues is bond deterioration ratings on these states. And, if they start getting to the point where they're getting downgraded, then those bonds become less appealing as what I would call conventional investments that could be held within, you know, traditional pension funds or within IRAs and things of that nature. And you're dealing with more of a junk, almost not, you know, somewhere in between a conventional bond and a junk bond status. Those bonds are going to be less appealing, and their revenue stream is going to be less appealing, and they're not going to have a whole lot of options available to them. Look, New Jersey and New York and California too, three states that have been managed predominantly by left of center policies for decades, are in enormous economic crisis. And they were in enormous economic crisis before this. Now you take the fact that those are three of the states that have been hit the hardest by this pandemic, especially New York and New Jersey, which, as I said, are over 40% of the total cases and 40% of the deaths from it. And obviously they're going to, you know, need special consideration and attention. And they just so happen to be, these are, you know, hugely economically important states in our country.
Yeah. Now Cuomo is under a lot of criticism. He's had the most deaths there in New York, as you just stated, throughout the country. The ratio and percentage of deaths in New York is astonishing. Certainly not a model we want to look at as comparing to other areas of the country, as you just said. I mean, there they've got a crisis for sure. But a lot of people, there's a lot of perplexing feelings about this, because here's the deal. His approval rating, Cuomo, now Governor Cuomo, is like well over 70% now. I mean, it's climbed quite a bit. It's up as high as, I think, 75 or so. And of course, some people are saying he would be a great vice president, presidential candidate for Biden. But of course, Biden has already said he wants a woman for that role, and he's already put himself in a corner. That could be a challenge. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But here's the thing with Cuomo I want to stay on here, is that, you know, he has had the most deaths there. Now, there's been a lot of bad moves with nursing homes around our country, where they've made wrong decisions. And the other thing about Cuomo is he's had the most draconian rules in place to prohibit the use of hydroxychloroquine. It's, you can't use it up there unless you're in a sampling or you're near death. And of course, the drug is not effective when you're near death. It's too late. I mean, that's only effective at the early stages. In fact, it's had tremendous successes around the globe in so many countries when it's used properly with zinc, and it's a recipe, and it almost is always effective. And so Cuomo, if for whatever political reasons people believe, hasn't allowed that in New York. He's had a complete crackdown on that. I mean, I'm thinking that's probably helped a lot of these deaths up in New York. And what I'm asking is, where's the accountability for these politicians? Why is the public being fooled with Cuomo? Because I don't think he's done a good job up there managing this crisis in New York. When you look at all this and you measure it up and you look at the deaths, I think some of his actions, in fact, I've had doctors on the program tell me he's got blood on his hands. You know, Michael, what do you think about that with Cuomo?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about it. I agree with what you've said. I think when you're talking about, I give you the number, 306,158 cases in New York State out of 1,067,382 nationally. Mm-hmm. That's over 30%, or roughly 30% in the country. You almost got to look at whatever you're doing in that state and say whatever's being done there is not proving particularly effective. And the decision that was made, I probably wasn't a decision by him personally, but at least was made by his public health department to put patients with active COVID-19 diagnoses, mm-hmm, into closed nursing home conditions, including shared rooms, is
insane.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's obviously one factor, and you know, I'd be curious to know how big of a factor, but you can't say it was that it didn't have an effect. It clearly had a hugely detrimental effect. Mm-hmm. On therapeutic approaches to this, you know, let's remember that continues to be guided predominantly by federal, not state policy, though there could be state issues on inventories and whatnot. And we have off-label uses available. I think doctors need to be given broad discretion in the treatment of these cases, and even preliminary studies, which
absolutely
may not be on this, is, and I'd say this having worked in the pharmaceutical industry, is that preliminary studies, which are sometimes immediately discounted when they come out. You always see more research is needed. You always say, we'll get the research done already, right? But these preliminary studies in a pandemic are very intriguing and relevant because you have kind of two different classes of studies. You have class number one is, what do we need to get a medication approved for this indication through the federal Food and Drug Administration? And that requires the double blind placebo traditional tests that are going to, they're going to have broad demographic sampling and, you know, could be completely statistically reliable. That we need to have that happen. That's difficult to do because you have to have individuals volunteering to participate in it who have the condition and have a 50% chance of having a placebo medication. It raises a whole other set of problems. But then you have these preliminary test results, particularly some of the ones that came out in France, which I agree with you, I thought looked incredibly encouraging with over 90% recuperation rates and things like that. And say at least allow physicians in the United States, as they do have currently the ability to do, to prescribe this for off-label uses. This has been used in a broad range of other ailments.
Malaria, rheumatoid arthritis. It was approved at the FDA back in the 50s. There's a whole history of this drug.
Very, very prominently used with rheumatology-related ailments.
Yeah.
And primary usage in malaria.
It's got to be political. And the fact that the President Trump came out and said the things he said about it, the press briefing. I mean, let's face it, all the media ran with those headlines and they politicized the hell out of hydroxychloroquine and called the president the nut job for saying that, just as they've done other things. You know what I mean?
Well, that's hugely, hugely irresponsible. And you know, a few points. Number one, I've thought as I've watched these White House press briefings, which I noticed they're now sitting every other chair, so they're practicing distancing within these White House press conferences. But if the White House press conferences can occur without any real acknowledgeable threat to the public health of the individuals that are participating, which by the way, include the President and Vice President of the United States and some of our key public health officials, I think we can allow churches and synagogues to open with those same protocols.
That's it.
A second issue on what you said about Cuomo, which I think is very well taken, a point you articulate very well, is that when you have probably the worst record statistically in the management of this condition in the entire country, to see an individual's popularity, political popularity, actually rising suggests to me that we're placing way too much focus on his somewhat folksy rhetoric in these press briefings in Albany.
We'll take a quick pause, friends. Back more with Michael Johns in just a moment. It's your news and entertainment network. News blogs, informative podcasts, entertaining videos, or listen to 24/7 talk radio on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. We the People, AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Listen to Malcolm, the voice of a nation, on iHeartRadio or our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa.
Here we're talking with Michael Johns, and we're doing a whole complete deep dive on this the pandemic. And I think people are losing their patience. You see de Blasio and what happened, the mayor of New York City, and what happened with the Jewish community. He came out, he put a tweet out. Something absolutely unacceptable happened in Williamsburg tonight. A large funeral gathering in the middle of this pandemic is what de Blasio said. Talk about stepping into it. He said, when I heard, I went there myself to ensure the crowd was dispersed. And what I saw will not, in all capital letters, Michael, will not be tolerated so long as we are fighting the coronavirus. My message to the Jewish community. Now, this is important because the Jewish community went ballistic. I mean, listen, I'm going to say to you something here. This is not the way to win elections in New York City in the future. If you're going to piss off the Jewish community, you can forget about it. Let me tell you what, you ain't going to win mosquito control in New York City without having the support of the Jewish community. Let's face it.
Yeah, no, you know, kind of rhetorical question for Mayor de Blasio. I mean, is attending a Jewish funeral any more outrageous than attending a public gym as he did in the middle of this pandemic? Seems to me there's some like extraordinary hypocrisy in the acts and verbiage of him. I believe we need to put a lot of these issues into almost various categories. The ones that are hugely unacceptable to me are the ones that are undeniable violations of our Bill of Rights and Constitution. And I've seen an extraordinary number of those. This likely falls in that category. When you are attempting to prohibit individuals from gathering in the practice of their respective religion on a religious service of any sort, that is a pretty clear-cut First Amendment violation. And these Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, the 10th Amendment, these are all very clearly written without footnotes, without caveats, without exceptions. They're absolute rights. That may be very bothersome to some on the far left. If it is bothersome to them, our founders were wise enough to offer methodologies through which they could amend or change the Constitution. But what we've got to get away from is not abiding by the Constitution, pretending it doesn't exist, turning it on and off as we see fit. I noted a few things that I saw as well that I thought were completely unacceptable. And these are things that I think like where we really need to be focused on. Some of these lockdowns themselves are clearly unconstitutional.
Well, that's what Musk said. I started the program today with you. You would agree with what Musk said then. It's unconstitutional, he said. He come right out, right? I read that when we started. Listen, on that New York City, by the way, the Anti-Defamation League and the New York City Council are calling out Mayor de Blasio. Well, what they're saying is that he should not have been condemning the whole Jewish community and targeted.
Yeah, I don't like any part of that, what he said. I don't like, number one, I disagree with him on principle about the issue. Number two, to single one particular religion out is very rhetorically irresponsible, and and I can understand like
well, Michael, I'll tell you what, I hope they remember this come election time in New York. I pray that people don't have short memories about, in fact, I pray from sea to shining sea that every American remembers everything that's going on here. And remember your president up at those daily press briefings and the leadership he has provided to this country. I hope people remember that as well.
You know, I believe we ultimately have to be responsible citizens here. I mean, we're going to be responsible for the public health ramifications of all the steps that we take. And so you can't be blind to that. And I don't like what I see in some of these corners of, you know, some conspiratorial thinking or dismissiveness of the actual threat. That's not really good policy. It's not good politics. And it's not ultimately helpful to our ends. But there are ways to go about this, both in peaceful protest, in the ballot box, where we should be supporting liberty-minded candidates, and ultimately, if necessary, in the courts. I mean, which is why these federal court appointments are so important. I mean, I have a case here, Newark, New Jersey, okay? Now prosecuting individuals for making false statements about COVID-19. Clear First Amendment violation, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, how many false statements are made any day about any number of things? This is now a prosecutorial crime in Newark, New Jersey. San Jose, California, which has left many retail stores open, has, however, closed gun shops. So you can go to any one of a number of retail stores, but not a retail store selling guns. Clear to me that's a pretty graphic Second Amendment violation. And there's dozens of these things that are emerging. And I like the fact that the president has instructed our attorney general to look for these and to challenge them. So one of the things I would say of many things that the president's done well here, he responded assertively and early with the travel ban. He has taken this as seriously as a public health threat. You're describing a set of circumstances that, you know, a lot of people are sort of looking at it and saying, you know, was it even an over response? But part of it is, look, our federal government and this president took it really seriously. He's also taking opening the economy really seriously. And most importantly, nothing that I've seen, at least that's crossed my eyes, since this started on behalf of the president, has in any way breached any fundamental rights or constitution.
I agree, he has walked that fine line. But don't you think at this point it's time to open the country back up as a whole? I'm saying, again, I'm not talking about those pockets or what have you. But isn't, I mean, what's the delay at this point? You just mentioned, first of all, you and I agree that a lot of many local leaders have gone too far. It's a bridge too far where a lot of these people have gone and back to our constitutional rights. And that's happening. They're taking advantage of the situation. But isn't it time the president now have a brief and to say, you know what? And I know he's got Birx and Fauci and all these wholesome people up there telling him what to do or how to do it. But isn't enough enough?
Well, I think he said that we're, you know, into a phase of opening states on a selective basis and doing it incrementally. He's encouraging those states to work with the administration, which is great guidance, meaning you want as much data and, and information available. And I think, you know, my position, at least today on this, which could be different a week from now, but at least today, I say you can't really look at this holistically. You have to say, there's a huge number, large, significant number, maybe even a lion's share number of states that certainly appear to have overly restrictive economic policies in place, and they need to be relaxing those incrementally immediately. Then you've got kind of the rest of these states, including two of them, that are in full-blown pandemic emergency, lights flashing red, fire alarms going off loud, states of emergency, and clearly those can't be thrown in with the rest of these states. They need to be, you know, the opening of that, those economies are inevitably going to be slower and more restrictive.
Well, I'm going to tell you, I believe that the time, based on what you're saying, the time has come. And if things don't open up more rapidly now, back to the protests you were just talking about, and I think you're going to see more and more of those. I think Americans are losing patience. Not a lot of room anymore. Do you agree with that?
I do. I also, you know, followed the polling on this pretty closely, and whatever you want to kind of suggest is the way of being, you know, I'm sure we both share some skepticism of polling numbers, but I do notice the American people still having some sentiment of deep concern about their own personal exposure here. And, so for instance, once you started to see these protests arise, one of the things you would typically see, for instance, we saw it in our Tea Party movement, like numbers literally just shifted in our direction to a point where we had more Americans supportive of the Tea Party movement than they were of the Republican Party. In this case, this happened. I didn't see the shift in people's sentiment or perception. A number of the people who organized these state protests actually got the virus afterwards. And I think it's suggestive that the opinion of the American people is mixed. Yes, they want to see the economy reopened and normalcy restored. But when you have over a million cases nationally, that's, you know, like,
well, here's the thing.
300 KP Americans who've contracted this to date. It's a serious thing.
If certain Americans or pockets of folks are concerned, well, then they should be concerned and stay in lockdown mode. The truth of it is, Michael, if that, and I think that's a minority now of people that are concerned in the way that you've said, because they've seen the wrong numbers, they've seen the models wrong, they've seen the amount of death wrong, and they've seen the impact of this not really hit them in their lives. And so here's what I would say. Those people who are at risk, those people who are concerned, they should stay in lockdown mode. Absolutely. No one's forcing anybody to get out of their homes or businesses, by the way. But the rest of the people, they want to get on with some sort of normalcy of life. So my question back to where I started, because I think a lot, I'm hearing from people every day on this platform here, and I the ratio of people that are upset with this, it's massive and it's growing by the hour. And people, I think patients are losing. I think, as you've said, the protests, I think you're only seeing the tip of the iceberg now. So here's the thing. What about if we, the questions that history is going to ask back on this, history is going to ask, did we go too far? You know, if I had said to you a year ago that we were going to be locking down the entire country, you would have said to me, you're out of your mind, Malcolm. You need to get some mental therapy here for yourself. You would have said that to me. With respect, you would have said it, but, and I would have probably agreed with you. Now here we are, and we've done it. So what if we, back to where history looks at this thing, and they look at what happened and how we handled it, would we have been better served, I ask that difficult question, to have maybe quarantined the people more at risk? They knew the people that were going to be at risk. The vast majority of the population was perfectly to keep working and living their life. What was wrong with that scenario, do you think?
Here would be my response. I think a lot of these issues, including in this, lend themselves to really emphatic black and white statements regarding it. And when we have a situation like this that emerges, it's got a lot of components of gray in it. It becomes frustrating for people. So, for instance, are the 60 plus thousand Americans to date who've died from this, all those who were in that risk category that you described? No, there were thousands upon thousands who weren't, who were in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, okay, and were didn't have comorbidities, didn't have predisposed risk. Which doesn't lend itself to the sort of emphatic black and white answer that I think human instinct is that we want to be able to say it's this, it's A or it's B. Well, in this particular case, there's a little bit of A, there's a little bit of B.
Interesting.
You know, are we committing national economic suicide with these voluntary measures that we've taken to destroy the most prosperous economy in the history of the universe? No, that's a legitimate question.
It is.
Does this recommend a national public health crisis that could ultimately take millions of lives? Mm. I think that's pretty indisputably true as well. And so those questions are going to be looked at, as you correctly say, historically. In the meantime, there's a lot of things that we can be doing that aren't in that A or B category. I think a lot of the regulatory issues need to be reevaluated in light of this. We can lighten up some of the regulations on small businesses that would be helpful to them. And education is very intriguing to me. Let me just raise this question. I haven't heard anyone else raise it. I was thinking about it, but you know, every student in school is, you know, their parents are being taxed, you know, for basically, well, this is based on property values for education in these school districts. Now, all of a sudden, for like the final few months of this school year, they've been at home, not receiving the services that were already paid for. Aren't they due rebates, refunds for those services that could potentially be used, like school choices, for alternative education measures, like online education?
That's a good point.
Or the purchasing of books or tutoring, things of that nature? Why would we not be giving back to parents some amount of money that obviously for services that were not rendered in the educational world? And I think if you went through sector by sector, you would find a lot of issues like this that we could do that don't represent any threat to the public health, but would make life a little bit easier on those who've been clearly so profoundly impacted by this.
Yeah. Listen, I want to talk to you in our remaining time about the election. Let me read you this from Politico. Interesting. It says, here's a question worth pondering. Given how off many people were in 2016 with their presidential predictions, do you feel at all comfortable making any predictions right now when, Politico poses this, the president's approval numbers have not cratered over the course of the biggest national crisis in nearly a century that has the economy in the gutter? Joe Biden, the Democrat candidate, is relegated to his basement. Most Democrats believe they will not have a traditional convention, which could starve his campaign of the post-convention bump that he desperately needs. And lastly, Joe Biden is under increasing pressure to respond to a sexual assault allegation from 30 years ago when he was senator. And the Washington Post editorial board came out and they called on him to provide some answers, as many others in America are doing that. So when you look at that, looking at now the election here, Michael, and let's get on the record here, we're talking about 2020. It's hard to think of the fact that we are just months away from electing the president. I mean, it's crazy because it doesn't feel like a election year, does it, with all this pandemic business going on? It's so odd and so removed from our normal politics right now. What do you make of all that and the way Politico addresses that with the president's approval numbers? They talk about Joe Biden, the basement, and won't have the post-convention, again, the sexual assault allegation. What do you think?
Well, I think I mentioned to you that when you look at these, you know, again, caveat to the polling numbers that they are what they are, that's the only thing we have to do. It is conjecture. Obviously, is it an appropriate sample? That's a question. Are people answering these questions honestly? We've learned from 16 that the answer is not always. Sometimes they tell pollsters what they want to hear, not what they really are going to do. And when someone says, I'm going to go out and vote for Donald Trump, or I'm going to go out and vote for Joe Biden, do they in fact on November 3rd, 2020, leave their house to go and cast the ballot that they said they were going to? Those are all, you know, big question marks. But I think it's intriguing on a few levels here. Number one, that the president's support, as the Politico piece mentions, and you mentioned, has been basically sustained throughout this. Number two, that the support for his management of the coronavirus has been, over the last few weeks, several points higher than his overall approval rating. Why is that important? Because in my judgment, this campaign has now just been flipped completely on its head. We had a president who was going to run a campaign saying, you know, I came to Washington, D.C. saying I would revive this economy, I would drain the swamp, I would change the way things were done, and I would, you know, make America great again. And he had a campaign lined up that on every one of the statistical components of that showed that he delivered on that. The economic metrics of the country were very strong. The national security and foreign policy metrics were very strong. The progress on trade was very strong. The number of boxes that could be checked on him keeping his promises was very strong. Now, in spring of 2020, we're looking at, I think, a country and a discourse and a thought process that looks at that in the rearview mirror and is now looking forward and saying, yeah, but what now? So no one is looking that, no one, you know, of uncertain political orientation or in the Trump base, no one whose vote he would realistically get before this would put any blame on this president or his administration for the fact that this has hit us. I think every reasonable American understands that the president did not invite this, did not ask for it, and has done just about everything in his power to keep it at bay. And there may, in fact, be ultimately recourse against the government of China and or the World Health Organization for steps that they did not take or things that they did do that actually inflamed the situation. So I don't think that that's going to be the issue, but the discourse around this actual campaign has clearly now shifted, because I think in the minds of most Americans, the question now is not, well, gee, you did a great job over these 3 years. That's hopefully still in people's minds, because I think it's suggestive that he can do it again. Mm-hmm. But the question also becomes, who is better to manage this moment of national crisis in the country? And I start to answer that question by saying, who was the candidate who would have stopped the bleeding earlier in this situation, you know, with the January 31 travel ban that the president put in place against China, which happened to have this quote right here. Joe Biden said, this is no time for Donald Trump's record of hysteria and xenophobia, hysterical xenophobia and fear mongering is what he said. That was Joe Biden's position. So he would have allowed travel from China, but who knows until when. I mean, it certainly would have gone beyond January 31, into February, maybe into March, maybe in April, maybe he'd still have it ongoing. And I think once that is communicated to the American people, everything else that's been done, all this debate around ventilators, the therapeutic approaches to the disease, whether our social distancing policies have been too restrictive or not restrictive enough, those are really subjective questions that impact this thing on the margins. The biggest decision was to stop the bleeding, because if you had continued to have tens of thousands of individuals come into this country from China and other affected regions of the world, I think any thinking person realizes that our death would not be over 60,000, be over 600,000.
Yeah, that is perfectly said. The president also responded to what you're saying. He said he did not expect the election to be a referendum on his handling of the pandemic, and added he was surprised the former vice president was doing as well as he was doing, quite frankly. The president went on to say, Michael, he said, I don't believe the polls. I believe the people of this country are smart, and I don't think that they will put a man in who's incompetent. And what I really like about this, and this is a moment to think about for everybody, he went on to criticize Joe Biden's decades-long record as a U.S. senator and as Barack Obama's vice president. And this is where you come in, Michael, to get your last thought on this, because it was perfect the way the president sized it up. And I love this. He said this, and I don't mean incompetent because of a condition that he's got now, like this cause of dementia and forgetfulness or whatever, if it is or isn't, you know. He said, I mean, he's been incompetent for 30 years. Everything he ever did was bad. His foreign policy was a disaster. Michael, that's a drumroll statement right there.
Well, it is, because I think Donald Trump has changed the politics of the moment, meaning we're now going to have a Democrat nominee who was all chips in on the Iraq war and occupation and the escalation of that conflict versus a Republican incumbent who has for a long time now expressed grave reservations about our overextension of military presence and nation rebuilding in that region of the world. I think the American people are with Trump on this, not with Biden, but that kind of reverses the political dynamic that's historically existed. You have, you know, what are Biden's actual legislative accomplishments in these four decades? I mean, they're pretty darn minimal. Let me just start by telling you that to think that you're going to send Joe Biden to the Oval Office and somehow this nation and world are going to be a whole lot different. You know, someone who is a change maker would have changed a lot of things by now in the positions that he's had, and he's done very little. He's been harsh on crime. Trump's been the guy who's been behind criminal justice reform and, you know, belief that we have too many people in jail. I just think across a lot of these broad numbers, he does not cut Medicare and Medicaid or VA. Biden has rhetorically and otherwise championed cutting Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security benefits. Now, he's going to try to have a revisionist policy on that, but his quotes are all out there to be found, where he said emphatically that he felt Medicare and Social Security need to be cut, whereas the president has said they cannot and should not be cut. So if you're over 65 or approaching 65, do you want to go vote for Joe Biden, who clearly emphatically has said throughout his whole career that he believes that's where government spending should begin, with Social Security and Medicare? I don't see his campaign standing for anything bold, which is a problem, because I think you win on bold ideas like Trump did in 16, like Obama did, as much as I disagree with him in 08. You win with bold vision. I don't see any boldness coming out of his campaign.
Amen to that.
And on the historical, rhetorical, and voting record that he has, seems to me he's sort of on the wrong side of a bunch of these issues, at least as they're perceived by the American people. American people are tired of our ongoing military presence in that region of the world. They're pleased to see the president pulling back a bit. They don't want to see our security compromised, but they think we've been overextended. They don't really want to see these programs that they've paid into unnecessarily cut, and I just don't. And I think on the criminal justice issues, I think they tend to agree that there's way too many people, particularly nonviolent Americans, in jail who shouldn't be in jail.
It's going to be interesting these next few months for sure as we move forward through this thing, I'll tell you. A tremendous, tremendous thank you here to Michael Johns. It was great to have him on for the hour with us and to do a deep dive in all of this. There is the fallout from the pandemic and the patience that the country is losing. Use history as a guide, but let's move forward. And now let's open up the country and hold these local politicians accountable. And the other thing I say to you is don't forget your local leaders and what they've done throughout all of this. Leadership matters. It matters a whole lot. Just don't have a short memory when you go and you vote in November, please. Thank you again for being with me here and being part of the mission. It's time to get involved and get loud.